Please open in your scriptures to the book of Exodus. We have come to Mount Sinai. We have come to the place in which the people of God will encounter God. In chapter 19, at verse 16, we're told, "On the morning of the third day, there were thunders and lightnings and a thick cloud on the mountain, and a very loud trumpet blast, so that all the people in the camp trembled. Then Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet God, and they took their stand at the foot of the mountain. Now Mount Sinai was wrapped in smoke, because the Lord had descended on it in fire. The smoke of it went like the smoke of a kiln, and the whole mountain trembled greatly. And as the sound of the trumpet grew louder and louder, Moses spoke, and God answered him in thunder. The Lord came down on Mount Sinai to the top of the mountain, and the Lord called Moses to the top of the mountain, and Moses went up." And here is where the Ten Commandments are issued to the people of God through Moses, but not just to the people of God, but to the world. To the world. And here we have a compilation of God's moral law. Now, these laws were new in the sense that the people had never had them actually etched in stone and handed to them, but these were moral obligations that were already carved in the conscience of men. In other words, God did not have to tell Moses, "You shall not murder," in order for the people to know that they should not murder or steal and so on. These were things that are already ingrained in the conscience of men, but now they are etched in stone and given to them so that now there is no question as to what is right and what is wrong. And last week when we looked at the Ten Commandments, we saw that the Ten Commandments actually expose what's in the heart. The things listed in these Ten Commandments in Exodus 20 are the very things that come out of our hearts when probed. It also shows that our holiness can be made possible, but only through Jesus Christ. As we look through the Ten Commandments, we see that it requires that we honor God. And as we read through the Scriptures, we see that we can only truly honor God through Jesus Christ. As the Word of God progressively reveals to us God's redemptive plan, we learn that it is through Christ that the Ten Commandments are actually doable. You see, the book of Exodus has everything to do with Christ. It is a picture of the Christ who's coming. And the Ten Commandments included. The truth is that I cannot make myself holy. However, through Jesus Christ, keeping the Ten Commandments, becoming holy, is actually conceivable. It's actually practicable. What the Ten Commandments do is that it brings us under the burden of sin in order then that Jesus Christ would relieve us from the burden of sin. And in that sense, the Ten Commandments are not restraining, they're liberating. They're liberating. It shows to us how God's law actually does bring freedom, not restraint. The Ten Commandments are not a choking leash around your neck. The Ten Commandments are actually a moral zone of safety, of security, of asylum. And those who abide within that zone will find true freedom. You move yourself away from this zone of the Ten Commandments, and you'll find yourself doing as you please, but devastating your own life. You'll find that your freedom becomes anarchy, and anarchy becomes destruction. And we saw last week as well that the Ten Commandments reveals God's demand for us to be personally holy. It's not just for everyone to be holy, but for me, you in particular, specifically, to be holy. The commandments are commandments for the individual, not just the group. so that if even I were living on an island, just me and one other person, the Ten Commandments would still be applicable. How about if I was living by myself? Well, Commandments 1, 2, 3, and 4 would still be applicable to me by myself. God has freed you so that you would be holy for Him. Well, having declared Himself as the Lord here at Mount Sinai, and you'll remember there are thousands, hundreds of thousands of people there. All the people of Israel have made their way to Mount Sinai. As we read there at the bottom of the mountain, Moses is called to the top of the mountain. Keep in mind that Moses is an elderly man and yet must be very strong. I don't think that the 80 years old of then is the same as 80 years old of today. There must be quite a contrast in human ability over time. It has changed. And here we see commandment number one. The great liberator, God Himself, pronounces this to Moses. He says, "You shall have no other gods before me. You shall have no other gods before me." Now, let's take a look at the requirements of this commandment. But in order to look at the requirements, let me just point something I think is very interesting and I think you should take to heart. You'll notice here that this first commandment is actually a choice to love God. It's a choice to love God. In fact, all 10 of the commandments are just that. It is a choice of whether or not you will love God. And if you choose to love God, if you are obedient to them, then there is blessing. However, you maybe you've noticed, I'm sure you have, if you do not choose to love God, then there is going to be consequences. So God says, choose life. Choose God. We are all here this morning as people who are given equally the privilege to love or to reject God. God gives out a call to all of us generally, come to me. And we each here have to respond and we decide how we are going to respond. The choice is given to all men as to what are you going to do with the Word of God. All men can see that He exists. Whether you see that He exists through His revelation, the Word of God, or, as Romans 1 tells us, by looking at creation, you must conclude that there is a Creator, a powerful and majestic Creator, who has brought about what we see and where we live. And God, having made Himself evident, says, choose who you will love. He says, I am the great liberator. I liberate you from the bondage of sin. And so it is indeed an either or choice. You have to decide, you have to choose for yourself, will I love this God or will I love this world? There's no room for two loves. Again, the commandment says, you shall have no other gods before me. One God. That's all you get. You get one God. Who will it be? And so indeed, it's a radical choice. It's a radical decision that you need to make as to who will be your God. At the very end of the book of Joshua, also in the Old Testament, chapter 24, Joshua says, choose this day whom you will serve. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. Right? To choose God, you must love Him. Yes, there is an emotional side to this loving of God, no question about it. But it's more than just simple sentiment. We're not just talking about I love God in an emotional way. To love God means that you will stick to your choice. To love God means you'll stick to your choice. It's like marriage, right? If I say I love you, then I have to stick to my choice. I may not feel like I love you today, but I have to stick to my choice. And that's how I display my love. And here God is saying, choose me, love me, and stick to your choice. To love God, my friends, you must love Christ. It is impossible, in light of the birth and death and resurrection of Jesus Christ, to say, I follow God, and yet reject Jesus Christ. In fact, Romans chapter 9 and 5 tells us that all divine worship belongs to Jesus Christ. It is impossible to love God outside of love for Christ himself. So here's the requirement. Here's the requirement of the first commandment. That you would know God and that you would acknowledge God as your one and only true God. That you would know God, that you would acknowledge God as your one and only true God. The commandment says that there is to be no other gods before him. There should be no other God beside him. As your God, it's not enough that you would say, well, I know God exists. You know, hell is going to be filled with people who said, well, I knew he existed. No, here we're talking about making God your true God, your priority. Now, Matthew Henry said that this first commandment is given to us because, look, quote, man had a maker to love before he had a neighbor to love. So we must love God first. God calls on you to make him your sole object of worship. In the epistle of 1 John chapter 3, verse 24, we're told that those who obey his commands live in him and he in them. The person who obeys this commandment and the others is the person who lives in Christ, but also Christ lives in you. That's the first commandment. You shall have no other God before me. Let's take a look at what the commandment forbids. What does the commandment forbid? It forbids that we would deny that God exists. It says you can't say that and do well. You cannot say that God does not exist and expect to fare well, not only in eternity, but even in this life here. Look at the words of God about himself. He says, I am the Lord. In other words, I am who I am. That's what the word Lord or Yahweh, Jehovah means. I am who I am. And here God is saying, I am who I am. You best acknowledge it. I forbid you to ignore it. So it forbids us from denying that God exists, but it also forbids us from denying the supremacy of God over every other God. I shall have no other God before me. Literally, this is how it reads. If you were to take word for word from the Hebrew, it says, I will have no other gods in my face. God precedes all. And he will not tolerate half-hearted worship. He's a demanding God, but after all, he is God. And if anybody deserves all of your heart, it's God. Isaiah 42 verse 8 reads, I am the Lord, that is my name. I will not give my glory to another or my praise to idols. And so the commandment forbids us to give supremacy to some other God. And also, number three, this commandment forbids us from denying God's supremacy in my own personal life. Me, individually, specifically, I am not allowed to place another God ahead of him. I think it's very easy to confuse our priorities. I know every day I'm one of those people who make a to-do list for my workday. And sometimes I get my priorities wrong. What I think I should be doing is not where I should be starting. And at the end of the day, I say, ooh, I should have taken care of this sooner. Maybe you're like me. The reality is, often you're like me when it comes to the things of God. We don't give God the priority he deserves. We confuse our priorities. Our conscience tells us very clearly that Christ has to be first today. We get out of bed, we say, Christ first today. That's what our conscience bears on us and tells us again and again. Our heart of hearts, in the depth of our hearts, we're like, oh yes, Christ first today. And then we have a schedule. And our schedule says, well, maybe not the very first. And then we have our desires, which pushes Christ further back, where we have our weaknesses, our flesh, which does not give then God supremacy in our lives. This is what happened to the rich young ruler in Luke chapter 19. The rich young ruler was just that. He was young, he was very rich, and he had some political position. He was a ruler in his community. And Jesus told him that if he were to sell all his possessions and then follow Christ, then he would be made perfect. Perfect here means whole. Because he had come to Christ and said, what must I do to inherit the kingdom of God? And Christ said, sell all that you have and then come follow me. And then you will be made whole. You'll be made perfect. And of course, he walked away very, very, very disappointed. The reason Jesus Christ said you must sell everything is because Christ was pointing out to this man his half-hearted devotion to God. He said, oh, I'm sold out. I'm completely sold out to God. I keep all these commandments. But he loved his money more than he loved God, or at least equally. And God said, I'm not going to share my glory, my worship with anybody, not even your money. And so he said, get rid of your money and then come follow me and then you will be made whole. Now everybody wants to be whole, right? That's what Micah made reference to just a few minutes ago. Everybody wants to walk away from whatever you're doing at the end of the day and said, yes, I did well, I am satisfied. You want to get rid of that aching void, that hollow in your heart, in your life. And Christ said, well, I could do that for you. This is what you need to do. Get rid of your other gods and follow me. He couldn't do it. That God was too precious to him. He walked away sad. You see, both were enthroned in his heart. God was sharing his throne with this man's money. Two irons in a fire. But God refuses to share his glory with an idol, including money. You know, getting rid of his wealth was a priority. It should have been a priority. Now listen, there's nothing wrong with being wealthy. If you are wealthy, good for you. Use it well. Enjoy it. However, if your wealth is now a god in your life, you're in trouble. You're in trouble. I do believe that some of us are not wealthy as God's grace. God has protected us by not giving us a lot of money. Because he knows our hearts, how quick we are to make that into our new God. And so the commandment forbids us from allowing another God to become our personal gods. It is a radical decision, isn't it? Then to follow after God. God, I'm going to choose to be fully, completely sold out to you, so that not only are you my main God, you are my only God. There is no other God in your face. It's crucial. And all the other nine commandments now hang on this very first one. By the way, we're only going to look at the first four this morning. Take a look at the second one. It's there in Exodus 20, beginning at verse 4. There we read, you shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above or that is in the earth beneath or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them, for I am the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing steadfast love to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. Here we have the second commandment. You'll notice that the first four commandments deal with how we relate to God, and the last six commandments deal with how we relate to other people. God and then people. And here once again we see God dealing with us and how we relate to Him. And we see what's listed as the purpose of idols. It's stated very clearly in verse 5. These images are not to be made for the purpose of bowing down to them, serving them, you know, working for them in order to win God's approval. This is unacceptable worship. Even though it's very common, right? Even though it's very common, it's unacceptable worship in the eyes of God. Whether the idol is on your front lawn or on your dashboard, well, people don't do that anymore, right? But there used to be a time where people would put idols on their dashboard. Little Christopher in particular, until he was decanonized. Poor guy. You know, you live your whole life and then you get decanonized. But we do have our icons, our idols, whether it's on the mantle or hanging on the wall. God says, no, this is not acceptable worship. Why are icons wrong? If you're like me, you probably wonder, what's so bad about icons? What's so bad about idols, even idols of Christ? Well, once again, Doma, who I mentioned to you last week, wonderful book on the very topic. He lists for us what's wrong with icons. Let me give you a few of the suggestions as to why idols are wrong. The first one is this. These icons, these idols, attempt to constrain God into a figure that's made by human hands. Icons attempt to constrain God into something that's made by human hands. We should not try to constrain God. And not only that, but it attempts to humanize God. Man-made efforts to comprehend the incomprehensible. We'll make a figure of it. In fact, if you read on here in Exodus 20 and beyond, you'll see that that's exactly what the people of Israel did, because they wanted to imagine what God looked like, and so they cast an icon, an idol. God said no. It also attempts to manipulate God. Worshippers of idol believe that if they parade that idol through the sanctuary, or if they parade that idol through the streets of Boston, you can force God, you can strong arm God to do as you command. It's an effort to manipulate God. Well, that's a dangerous place to be. It also tries to substitute God. Idols attempt to substitute God, the God who revealed himself through the scriptures, the God who's already revealed himself through his word, is now going to be replaced by an image. An image based on our conception, based on our imagination, and based on our craftsmanship, and then bolted to a wall. It also violates intimacy with God. To say that we need an image to better understand God is to say that what God has already revealed of himself is simply not sufficient. And so we need a more intimate way of worshiping God, and we'll create it ourselves. It replaces God's revelation, actually. Iconic worship says that God's written revelation is simply not enough. We need more, Lord. I know you told us a lot about yourself, but you know, we're visual learners and we need to see you. And God is saying, no, my word is sufficient for your soul, for your worship. And it also does ignore that God is spirit. In the Gospel of John chapter 4, we're told that we are to worship God in what? Spirit and in truth. Yes, truth is essential, but it's also a matter of the inner person worshiping God in spirit and in truth. So you see, icons are forbidden because they actually devalue the true God. Here is the third commandment. The third commandment. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. And so now we move from the person of God to the name of God, which is really the person of God. Do not misuse the very name of God. You see, the name of God is more than just a title. That's why saying, "Oh my God," is actually wrong. It's a sin. His name is more than just a title. There's greater significance to the name of God than what we are accustomed to when we think of names. And when you think of a name, a person comes to mind or a certain trend comes to mind. Maybe before your child was born, you leafed through some family names to see what name you're going to employ. Maybe you went through a book of children's names and chose which one you liked best, and you learn that Gertrude is out, Henry's out. Right? Nowadays, it's Olivia and Liam, most popular names in 2020. And that's how you chose a name. Maybe some of you chose a name because of the biblical value. That's my case. My parents wanted to give me a biblical name, and they sure did give me a biblical name. Maybe your concern was that when your child is 14 years old, your child's not going to be angry at you by the name you chose. So you made sure you got a very nice name. Well, whatever the case, whether it was personal preference or the latest fads or your worldview, when it comes to the name of God, there's a higher cause. There's a higher significance. Says, do not use the name of the Lord in vain. Vain means empty. Vain means do not use the name of the Lord in a worthless way or in a false way. So what's in his name? Well, you see, the name of God does not only denote who he is, but it also tells us what he is. When you look at me, my name does not tell you what I am. It just tells you who I am. But when we consider the name of God, it's not just who he is, but what he is. The name of the Lord means I am who I am. The eternal, self-existent, unchanging creator and sustainer of everything that exists. That's what Lord means. That's what God means. So that when we think of the name of God, we are thinking of all the attributes of God. We are thinking of the fact that he is just, that he is love, that he is merciful, that he is gracious, that he is omnipotent, omnipresent, and omniscient, and so on. So when you think God, you're thinking quite a bit. It's not just what we call him, it's who he is. So that the misuse of God's name means you're actually scorning the person. The misuse of his name actually means that you are defaming God himself. You are belittling him. In Psalm 29 verse 2, we read this. Ascribe to the Lord the glory due his name. His name. Not just his person, but his name. Worship the Lord in the splendor of his holiness. So what are some examples of misusing the name of the Lord? What are some examples of violating this commandment, do not use my name in vain? Well, it would behoove us to be careful not to use the name of the Lord in a thoughtless or careless way. I know in the Latino culture it is very common to say, "Oh my God," in Portuguese or in Spanish. It comes out as naturally as good morning, hello, or how you doing? And it is wrong. It is a frivolous, thoughtless, careless use of the name of God. It's also wrong to use the name of God in a jokingly way. And the name of God is not a name you want to use in a joke. Or to use God's name as a filler. Sometimes we do that when we're praying. We don't know what to say, so we say, Lord. Be careful. Be careful. If you don't mean it, don't say it. If you mean it, say it. You know, preachers use the name of the Lord as a filler quite often as well. Maybe you've heard them. Hopefully you haven't heard it from me. But instead of saying or they say Lord or God. And that's really not the proper use of the name of God. It's just filler. But more commonly, some people use the name of God to put more power behind their words. You've seen it. People who say, I swear in the name of God. Well, now you're serious. But you really, do you really mean that? Do you really want to covenant with God over what you're about to say? Sometimes to put power behind our expression, we use the name of God as an exclamation. Good God. That's using the name of the Lord in vain. Good Christ. That's using the name of the Lord in vain. Because you don't mean it. If now you really do mean good God, well then good. Use his name. But if it's just an expression, I would say, set it aside. Sometimes people use the name of God in order to sound more credible, right? In order to make people believe you. I swear in the name of God. Well, now I best believe you because you just swore in the name of God. But they really don't mean it. And sometimes people will even say that to be deceptive and credible. Be careful how you use the name of God. Sometimes people use the name of God in a shocking way, in a surprising way. When they are suddenly angered or shocked, they use the name of God. That's also a violation of this third commandment. But the worst one of all, the worst one of all, is when we use the name of God to curse people. To curse people. And we call on God to curse them, to damn them. That is a violation of the third commandment. And the words are clear. God is not okay with it. He's not okay with it at all. You shall not take the name of the Lord, your God, in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. It's important that we are careful as to how we use the name of God. And let me say this. I don't think that we need to live, whether it's at school or at work, listening to people using God's name in vain over and over and over again. You know, in this world where we have so many people patrolling language, I think we could actually get away with saying, hey, listen, you know, what you're saying is not good. I find it interesting that never do we say, good Buddha, do we? In the name of Allah, no. Good Muhammad, no. It's only the name of God and Christ in particular that we swear or blaspheme or curse people in. So how can you approach people who are constantly using the name of God in a wrong way? I would say, first of all, speak to them with humility. Do not come to them with this, I'm more righteous than you, attitude. But rather speak to them personally, privately, in humility. And explain how it troubles you, how it bothers you to the core to hear God's name being used wrongly. Again and again and again. And they'll probably say something like, oh, I really didn't mean it. Just say, yes, I realize you didn't mean it, but I want you to know that it is highly, highly offensive to me. And I would ask you not to do that, at least not when I'm around. There's no reason for it. But you might want to remind them that not only does it trouble you, but it troubles God even more when they use his name in vain. So it is to their benefit to not use God's name in vain. And I believe that in most cases, not every, but in many cases, I guess it depends where you spend most of your week, with whom you spend most of your week. I think that in most cases, people will actually respect you and honor your request. Although they might jeer you behind your back, but that's okay. They're not using God's name in vain, at least not in front of you. Right? But I do think we have the right and even maybe the responsibility to ask people not to. And here we have commandment number 4. Commandment number 4 begins at verse 8 and runs down to verse 11. It's the longest of the 10, certainly the longest this morning. And it begins at verse 8. It says, "Remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy." Remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. The length of this commandment should alert us to how serious God is on the matter. We looked at this commandment just a few weeks ago when we were looking at the manna that was coming down from heaven and how God said, don't collect anymore on Sunday, and rather on Saturday, on the seventh day of the week. And we looked at the significance of the Sabbath then. But for this morning, let me give you the briefer version. Let me just say that these are the requirements. Look there. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. The requirements are this. One is rest. Rest. Put aside work. Put aside your daily obligations. And number 2, keep it holy. Keep the Lord's day holy. In other words, separate it from the other 6 days of the week. Separated from the other 6 days of the week. The Lord's day, not working, doesn't mean you just loaf around and you take elongated naps all day, right? It means you consecrate the day to God. You consecrate it to God. I'm always surprised as I drive here early Sunday mornings as how there's no traffic whatsoever on Sundays. Okay? During the week when I'm here, it's the traffic, back and forth. People beeping at me when I'm trying to make a left into the driveway. On Sundays, everybody's home resting. That's good. Good. But now, let's consecrate it to God. We got step 1 right. Now let's get step 2. It's a consecration to God. Keep it holy. Let me give you quickly the significance in 3 steps, the significance of the Lord's Day and keeping it holy. You'll recall that, first of all, it is a sign of the covenant that God made with his people. Rather, not only only in the Old Testament, but also in the New Testament as well. It is a sign of the covenant God made with us. It's a day that reminds us that we are God's people. And the reason why we need a day that reminds us that we are God's people is because we forget that we are God's people. We do. We overlook it. We get used to being with everyone else. And we forget that we are the people of God. And that comes with requirements, correct? Liberating requirements. It's a sign of the covenant, meaning that God not only delivers us, but God provides for us. Let's not forget what God has done. I find it interesting that even a policeman is given a required age by which he needs to retire for both his good and the good of the community. Correct? And so God has given us a retirement day every week for our good and for the good of his community. It's called the Lord's Day. It's not only a sign of the covenant, but it's also an exercise of faith. We actually exercise faith by being here in the house of the Lord, worshiping him together. Not only do we reflect on what God has done for us in the past, but now we trust him for what he's going to do in the future. It is an active trusting in God for tomorrow. Now, this was especially true in an agrarian society, but it's true for us as well today, who have bills coming in almost every day of the week, and those bills have to get paid, and now we have to rest from our work. How are we going to pay those bills? Well, we are going to pay those bills by consecrating this day to the Lord and honoring Him and finding our rest. And let's see what God's going to do. And I assure you, God will provide for you if you honor His day. It takes a great deal of faith in many cases. It does. Now, I understand some of you are required. You have to be there at the hospital. You have to be there patrolling because you're in law enforcement. I understand that. You don't have that option. I'm working right now. Correct? But that's not the case for most of us. We can trust in the Lord. And we have to. It's an exercise of faith. Somebody said that if you remove the Sabbath, you also destroy faith. It's true. It's true. Our job is to imitate God. And we see here in Exodus 20 is that God worked for 6 days, rested one day. It is our duty to imitate God and therefore rest. Rest. He's our example. And also, this Lord's Day, this commandment here, is a reminder of the grace that God extends to us. The Lord's Day reminds us that God is a God of grace. From the very get-go, from Genesis chapter 1, we see God promising His grace when He rested. It is a reminder to us that God saves not because we religiously work hard at it to be saved, but rather when we rest in Him, He provides salvation. When I stop working hard for it, He provides. The Lord's Day is a reminder of His gracious salvation. So here we have, my friends, 4 of the 10 moral laws of God. And anyone who claims to be moral needs to begin here with the 10 commandments. In other words, you cannot be moral and be ignoring the 10 commandments. Which leaves you to what? You're immoral, is what it comes down to. But who here is not a sinner? We all are. We are all sinners. And God is a gracious, forgiving God. However, because of His grace, doesn't mean that we have the right to ignore His commands. And so we pursue them. We pursue them. And it all begins with turning to Christ. When we turn to Christ, all of a sudden, these commandments actually become our passion. We want to do these things. We don't always get it right, but we want to. Why? Because of Christ in us. And what you'll discover is that the more passionate you are about Christ, the more passionate you will be about these 10 commandments. And as you mature in Christ, these 10 requirements will not only liberate you, but they will make you. They will mold you. They will give you satisfaction. You will be whole. The more passionate you are about Christ, the more passionate you will be about not only these 4 commandments, but these 10 commandments. So next week we'll take a look at the next 6.